ID, the future. A podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Eric Anderson, and I'm pleased to be joined again by Dr. Howard Glicksman to continue our discussion about a recent paper describing the discovery of a mechanoreceptor that forms part of the critical systems controlling our blood pressure. Welcome, Howard.
Thanks, Eric. It's great to be back.
So, Howard, last time we talked about the discovery of this mechanoreceptor and how it mediates expression of the REN1 gene with an inverse relationship so that as the blood pressure increases, less of the gene is expressed, and as the blood pressure decreases, more of the gene is expressed. Today, I wanted to delve in a little bit more and discuss the next steps in the cascade and how that translates to a change in blood pressure, if that's all right.
Sure. And we had said that we have medication that takes into account this system is called the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. And so we've known that there must be a sensor to detect the pressure so they could adjust the renin. I just want to remind everybody that there's basically three physiological factors that affect blood pressure. If you have to keep these in mind so that when we explain how renin ultimately affects the blood pressure, you have to know what these factors are. So the first factor is the cardiac output, how powerful and how much blood is being pumped out by the heart every minute. The second one, which is probably the bigger component here for renin, is the arterial blood volume, which is usually related to the total blood volume, which is it was often related to how much sodium and water you have in the body. So imagine if you're dehydrated or you're bleeding, you're losing fluid, and then your pressure tends to be low in that setting. So that you can see the connection there. And the third thing is the downstream vascular resistance supplied by the smooth muscles around the arterioles. When they tighten, then that makes blood stay inside the artery more, and it takes a little longer for it to get into the tissue. So with that, as long as you understand those three things, we can sort of get into what renin does.
Yeah, that's helpful. So let me just state again so that we're all clear. Renin helps to increase the blood pressure. So if we have low blood pressure, these cells are detecting that and they're increasing the amount of renin that they're putting into our system. So what happens next, Howard, after this renin is produced?
Okay, so they sort of call renin a hormone, but ultimately it's really an enzyme as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is where it becomes really fascinating. And if you guys are, anyone's got a paper and pen there, you may want to start writing down these names just to keep track of it. But there's a protein that's made in the liver. It's called angiotensinogen. Long, big name, okay? Angiotensinogen. And as far as we know, it has absolutely no other function other than just to float around in the blood and wait to be affected by renin. So the very first thing that renin does, the only thing that renin does, is it enzymatically changes angiotensinogen into a chemical called angiotensin 1, all right? And just like angiotensinogen, angiotensin 1, as far as we know, doesn't have any function either in the body. It travels in the blood, and inside the lungs, there's certain cells in the lungs that have an enzyme on them called angiotensin converting enzyme, ACE, angiotensin converting enzyme. And they convert angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. And angiotensin 2, this is the active functional hormone that actually does the work.
Let me jump in for a second, Howard, because my alarm bells are going off. When you say it doesn't have any function in the body, I know you mean any known function other than being converted into angiotensin 2, right? But I'm thinking here as an engineer, there's a reason for this cascade. And it's going to have to do with the control systems coming back on itself. It's not just a Rube Goldberg in the sense that, you know, the fun thing about a Rube Goldberg visual, right, is that you were doing something really complex that could have been done in a simpler way. But if you look at something like the blood clotting cascade or here the renin cascade, boy, I've got to tell you, there's got to be a reason why we have these mediating molecules in this process that allows us to come back and control them at intermediate points in the process. So anyway, I'm not disagreeing with you. I just wanted to point out, you know, the way I would start looking at that as an engineer.
So I love this. This is what's so great about our discussion. Okay. I'm a doctor, right? I know how the drugs work and I know what these things do, but I'm not an engineer, but I've always thought about this and said, well, why do we have this? I know with coagulation, it sort of somehow makes it stronger. And I don't know, you know, what the reason is for having these other factors involved. I mean, they're part of the process, like you said, but it takes an engineer to think about that. Even those of us as physicians who are practicing I'm not sure we think that way. We're doing reverse engineering. We're trying to figure out how something works. But this is even a higher level of why you have to have these other parts. Why can't renin be angiotensin II?
Exactly. Okay?
And technically, here's the part I wanted to bring up, though. The reason why those others don't function, because as far as we know, there's no angiotensinogen or angiotensin I receptors. No hormone works on its own. You have to have a receptor. You'd have to have a renin receptor, which I don't think there is. Yeah. There's an angiotensin II receptor, and that's how it has its effect in the target tissues. And also, there is an angiotensin-converting enzyme II enzyme, which is scattered through many cells in the body. And just as a side issue, that's how the COVID virus gains access to cells. It's through if you've seen ACE2, ACE2, okay. This is the enzyme that breaks down angiotensin II. Okay, so the question now becomes, what does angiotensin II do? All right. Well, there's several things it does. The first thing it does, it goes to your brain and it tells you to take in salt and water. So you can already see that's affecting the volume. Remember I said three factors. The first is cardiac output. The second is the arterial blood volume, which is directly related to your total blood volume and total body sodium and water. So basically thinking that when the blood pressure drops, the body's response to that is saying, oh, we're running out of water. We're running out of sodium. Okay, the two are very important for your blood volume. So you take in salt and water. It also, angiotensin II also goes to the first part of the kidney. It's called the proximal convoluted tubule, but these tubules that are in the nephron, which filters the water, and it tells it to take back a lot of sodium. So you see the body's bringing sodium. The third thing it does is it goes to your adrenal gland, and it tells it to send out a hormone called aldosterone. So this is why it's called the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. So the angiotensin II attaches to angiotensin II receptors in the adrenal gland, and that tells it to send out more aldosterone. And aldosterone tells you to bring in salt, just like angiotensin II does. And it goes to another area in the kidney tubules, and it tells it to bring in sodium too. So you can see there's this major push to bring in salt, mainly salt, sodium, and sort of water as well. That's what it's doing. And the final thing it does, angiotensin II, interestingly enough, is the strongest vasoconstrictor in the body. It's even stronger than norepinephrine and epinephrine. It actually goes down, right down to the arterioles in those smooth muscles in the arterioles, and it makes them really tighten up, right? Very, very much.
Okay, and pause there for a second, Howard. Why is that related to blood pressure, the tightening of these muscles?
Well, good question. We just went back. So let's remember the three physiological factors that affect blood pressure. The first is cardiac output, how much blood is being pushed. As far as I know, angiotensin II doesn't affect cardiac function, the actual pumping of the blood, right? The second thing is the arterial blood volume, all right? Mm-hmm. How much sodium water do you have in the body? So you see how it's a major push to bring in sodium. Remember, the third factor is the downstream resistance of the arterial. Yeah. And that's what angiotensin II does. And just think of the name, angiotensin. Angio refers to blood vessel. Tensin is tension or pressure, right? So angiotensin II, its main claim to fame is that it goes down and really tightens up those blood vessels. That's why you can see that the two of the commonest blood pressure medicines we use block that effect. One is called an ACE inhibitor. So what it does is it blocks the conversion of angiotensin I to angiotensin II in the lung, because it actually blocks that enzyme. And there's another one called angiotensin II receptor blockers. So that's the second phase. You know, they came out later. And what they do is they actually go right down to where the receptor is, because the angiotensin II doesn't work unless it attaches to a receptor. Now, we have to ask the Darwinians, how can it work? You have to have the receptor. You have to have all these things going on at the same time for it to work. But anyway, notwithstanding that, that's how those blood pressure medicines work. So if you look at the whole picture, this is why the blood pressure starts to rise. As the renin level goes up, you ultimately get more angiotensin II. Mm-hmm. Angiotensin II tells your body to bring in lots of salt and water, and it also increases the blood pressure by increasing the systemic vascular resistance by tightening the smooth muscle around the arterioles.
Yeah, if I heard you right, it sounds like it also helps to conserve some of what would otherwise be lost in the kidneys.
Yes, it makes you hold on to salt and water as well.
And what's salt's role in all this? I mean, water, we're getting more volume of liquid, but what's salt doing for increasing the blood?
You got an hour or two? Basically, okay, here's a simple answer, okay? The chemical consistency of the liquid in your cells is exact opposite of what is outside your cells. Inside your cells, you have high potassium and low sodium. Outside your cells, you have high sodium and low potassium, right?
Yeah.
And as you may know, there's the sodium pump, sodium potassium pump exactly. because they're always trying to equilibrate. All right. So the cell is all you got. It's said that there's hundreds of thousands, maybe a million sodium potassium pumps in every cell, and they use up maybe at least a quarter or maybe a half of your energy total rest just keeping this chemical content the same. But the key thing is because of osmosis, wherever sodium goes in the body, so does water. Okay. So the reason why if you had no sodium in your body, you wouldn't have a blood pressure, you wouldn't have any interstitial fluid. All the fluid would go into your cells. So what keeps the water outside your cells and in the bloodstream is sodium, right? Hmm. Yeah, I jokingly when I tell my patients when I talk to them, I said, you know that insulin, if you don't have any insulin, you can still live a few weeks, maybe a month or two. But if you don't have any aldosterone, which controls sodium, you live about a half an hour.
Wow.
Yeah. So the lack of aldosterone is incompatible with life. You know.
Wow.
So.
Okay. Well, I won't have you spend 2 hours on that, but that's a great summary. Thank you. That's pretty interesting. So, you know, this whole renin system that you've talked about, which is pretty impressive and controls three different aspects, at least that we know of so far, right, is just part of a broader set of systems or group of systems that control blood pressure, right?
So yes, there are many other systems, but probably the two commonest ones and the listener can relate to. The first is the sympathetic nervous system. And basically, the best way to feel that its effect on you is if you bend over and you stand up quickly, you feel dizzy, all right? So okay. What's happened yep. is that the blood pressure drops because of gravity, the blood flow to your brain is reduced, the baroreceptors, you know, which are detecting blood pressure, just like, I guess, these receptors in the renal cell are doing, they send nerve messages instead of hormonal messages. We did mention that the hormone effect of renin, it does take several minutes, as opposed to when you bend over to stand up, you can't afford 3 or 4 mm-hmm, minutes right, to wait exactly. for the blood pressure, otherwise you're on the ground. And our ancient ancestors, I don't think, could have survived without it. So they had this neat system that, I don't know, came out of nowhere, sympathetic nervous system, that turns on and it sends out a hormone called norepinephrine. And the key thing with norepinephrine, if you go through it very quickly, is norepinephrine goes to your heart and it tells the heart to pump harder and faster. So there your cardiac output increases, right? And the other thing it does very quickly is goes to your downstream arterioles. Remember, I said angiotensin 2 is stronger, but norepinephrine is pretty strong too, and it makes those muscles contract. So that solves your
constricting those vessels, like we talked about before, right?
Right.
But now, this is a lot faster because this is nervous. Is that right?
Exactly. So it happens within a split second. Now, but the other thing that's very important, and this really affects people with heart failure, because when people have heart failure. You know, as we were just talking about a system where your pressure drops, maybe you have dehydrated, et cetera. Well, generally in the body, when these things go back to normal, then the nervous system goes back to normal. You know, the sympathetic nervous system says, hey, we solved the problem. The pressure's solved. You know, we got the fluid back in the body. We're just going to cut back how much we're putting out. And unfortunately, with people with heart failure, their heart doesn't pump efficiently all the time. So this becomes the new normal, and their sympathetic nervous system is sort of turned on a little more than usual. Mm-hmm. So norepinephrine also causes the body to bring in salt and water too, by similar to what angiotensin 2 and aldosterone do. So it does have an effect on the water as well. But probably the most dramatic effect is this thing that immediately solves your blood pressure problem when you stand up. Another system is basically, it's a hormone that's got two names. One's called vasopressin, the other one's called antidiuretic hormone. So by the term vasopressin, sort of like sounds like angiotensin, right? Vasopressin, the vascular pressure, okay? You basically have a very sensitive, you have a specialized cell in your hypothalamus in the brain that's able to actually be able to detect the amount of water in your body. And it's called the osmoreceptor. And in response to you getting dehydrated, these cells are very shrink sensitive. So when they shrink, and that, which is a sign that you're lacking water, they send out more of this vasopressin and it's also called antidiuretic hormone. This hormone does two things. It basically goes to your brain and says, bring in water, okay, and goes to your kidneys and tells it at another level downstream to hold on to water. In fact, this is the reason why if you're working outside the yard and you're sweating, you know, you haven't drank anything for a while, and you go, and then within an hour, you may urinate, but you pass very small amounts of concentrated urine, right? Mm-hmm. If you chug a lug, a liter of your favorite beverage, within an hour, you're urinating a lot of dilute urine. Well, this is the hormone that does it, because the cells in the hypothalamus are able to detect how much your water content is, and it sends out the antidiuretic hormone, which tells your kidneys within a few minutes how much water to hold on to. So, you know, it's detecting all this. And vasopressin also works like angiotensin 2 and norepinephrine in the downstream arterioles, making them contract to increase the pressure. So you've got three main systems, and there's others around too. But sympathetic nervous system, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, and then you got the vasopressin antidiuretic hormone system, which works out of the hypothalamus. So those three are always working together back and forth, keeping your pressure under control.
Yeah, and as you were talking there, it brings me back to what you stated earlier, which is it's not just the fact that we have to have all of these parts in place to work properly, but they have to maintain homeostasis within a narrow boundary. And all these systems, we've got subsystems and systems and systems of systems working together here to, you know, maintain this vital blood pressure that's so critical to our survival. It's just an astounding, you know, irreducible complexity squared, I guess, or cubed, right, exactly, or something.
Or, yeah, or on steroids, as Steve Laufman would call it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's really great. Well, hey, Howard, we could talk for hours, but I think our time's probably up. So I want to end with one quote from the paper. There's this great statement that they make at the end. They say, renin cells are crucial for survival. They are sensors with the exquisite ability to detect changes in arterial blood pressure and respond to those changes with exact amounts of renin released to the circulation to maintain blood pressure and fluid electrolyte homeostasis. I couldn't agree more. Certainly exquisite and remarkable systems. There's a lot more work to be done. There's a lot more exciting research that's going to come out in this area. But it seems like each time we delve a little deeper and learn a little bit more about these systems, the more we realize how astounding and remarkable they are and how ingenious the design is.
Yes, I agree totally.
Well, Howard, thank you so much for being here to help us understand these incredible systems. It's been really amazing to dig in and appreciate the deep and remarkable design that's evident right within our own bodies.
Well, thanks for having me, Eric. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. Join us again at idthefuture.com or on your favorite podcast app to learn more about the powerful evidence for design in the world. And as always, consider sharing a link with a friend. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.